Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, Hillary Clinton last night had her moment with Mr. O'Reilly. Earlier in the day, she was introduced to a steelworkers group by a fellow who said that what we really need in president is somebody who has,
I truly believe that that's going to take an individual that has testicular fortitude. You know, that's exactly right.
That's exactly right.
That's what we got to have.
That's what we got to have, testicular fortitude. Is this guy nuts? Carrie Lucas is with us. She is the Vice President for Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, the website IWF.org. Carrie, no shrinking violet and a good conservative. Hey, Carrie.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Do you think we need testicular fortitude in a president?
Boy, I don't know what new weird thing could happen in this primary season. It has just been off the wall. And I think that, you know, so much of this conversation about gender and race and what it is that we need in this country, I think a lot of this just needs to go by the wayside and start just focusing on people as individuals and the policy they support instead of all this nonsense.
Carrie, you're sounding like a liberal.
Oh, come on. No, that means you're sounding like a conservative.
I think that we can agree that statement is pretty ridiculous. But here's you know, where it gets interesting. And you know, the thing that you wanted to come on and talk about was this op-ed piece in the Financial Times by Lucy Kellaway on work. And she suggested, and she was quoting the spring issue of the London Business School's Journal, which said basically if women ran the world versus men, it wouldn't make much difference. In fact, 91% of women don't particularly like pink. And she wanted to say, if you talk to a man and a woman doing identical jobs, the woman is likely to talk about luck and coincidence. The man will congratulate himself on his skill. That's one of the few distinctions, is how people perceive their fortune, their good fortune or bad fortune, as the case may be. But she says, does this mean a world run by women would be nicer? On the contrary, everyone would be endlessly having to shore up each other's flagging confidence and say, no, your bum does not look that big. Now, this is a woman writing this column. Your assertion is that we don't necessarily need to do as the Scandinavian countries have done and try to achieve gender parity in governance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that this whole idea that women are better suited for running the world, or that they would be able to stop wars and all this you know, somehow do a better job than men are at running the world, is really, you know, it's I don't know, it strikes at me as fairly sexist to assume that women are so different in all ways that we are going to be able to fix the problems of the world. I'm a firm believer that there are differences in genders, and we do have some different perspectives and different priorities, and that it is helpful to have all different opinions. But when it comes to facing the problems that we face as a country, this isn't really a matter of gender. It's one sex isn't better suited to solve
don't,
the problem.
Don't you think so? That the fact that well over 90% of the people in prison are men speaks to something about testosterone? I'm serious.
You know, I do think that there's certainly, it's funny though, because I feel like so often when we talk about gender differences, we're all very comfortable in talking about times when men are worse and things like men are more violent. You get universal agreement. Everybody knows that men have more issues with violence and commit more crimes than women. But you can never say anything that women are worse at. I feel like it becomes politically incorrect the second you say that there may be something that men are better suited for. Even you get, you know, it becomes awkward even if you start talking about matters of physical strength. Or some of the issues in being.
Well, I think there's a consensus there, but for example, you say that we shouldn't strive for gender equality. You know, Ben Franklin, when he introduced the 37 Iroquois observers to the Constitutional Convention in 1787, made the observation. He said it would be an extraordinary. I'm paraphrasing, but I think I'm pretty close. From memory, he said it would be an extraordinary thing if five nations of ignorant savages have been able to forge a bond that has existed in peace for over 1,000 years, and 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can't do the same. What he forgot to point out was that in five of the six Iroquois nations at that time, men did not have the right to vote. They held office. They held high political office, but they could not make decisions. They had to go back to their local communities, and the women were the only ones who had the right to vote in five out of the six Iroquois nations. I believe it's still that way. If you look at the Nordic countries, I find this particularly fascinating. And you know, perhaps because my father's, you know, side is from Norway, I've spent a lot of time in Scandinavia, but the Norwegians were the horrors of Europe. I mean, you look at all the castles built in the UK and along the western coast of Europe, from you know 1500 years ago up until maybe 300 years ago, and most of them were to defend against invasions from the Vikings. They you know robbed, raped, pillaged. They were just it was a god awful thing, and now 41% of the legislators in the Scandinavian countries are women, and the leaders for peace in the world are the Scandinavian countries.
Yeah, but I don't think we should take this too far. I think that a lot of these countries and these examples have, there's a lot else going on. Yeah, I do think that when you...
Well, we could flip it around. In the Arab states, you have only 9.6% women involved in legislation, and they seem to have some problems with violence there.
Sure. Well, absolutely. And I do think that when you look at there are places in the world where women are not allowed any political participation, and you can tell that there's a lot of huge human rights violations, particularly against women. So I'm all for women need to be involved, and we need to be active players in the political process. But I don't think it should surprise us. I absolutely believe that women need to be involved and have every opportunity to participate, but we shouldn't expect, particularly in the American system, that we're going to come out with exactly that there's ever going to be a point where women are going to, there's going to be a larger number of female representatives than males. And one of the reasons is because, you know, our the current process of getting elected is horrible. Very few people would want to go through it.
It's that kind of competitive blood sport stuff that men seem to do quite well at. So if we were, first of all, do you think it might be desirable for us to say that one of our goals as a society is to, even if we're not going to mandate it, but as the Scandinavian countries, many of the Scandinavian countries have done, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, if instead of mandating it and Iceland, if we were instead to say, you know, we're just simply going to set as a goal a higher level of female participation in our federal and state legislative bodies. And first of all, if you think that that might be a good thing, how do we do that? How do we systemically take on this? The system that you've rightly characterized as being one that really is male blood sport combat.
Well, you know, I think, first of all, I think that we need to be careful that I don't think women do participate. We vote in larger numbers than men. Women have tremendous political power. The fact that women aren't as many of us in Congress and/or in state legislatures, that's a different thing. And I'm sure you as a good liberal would not think that that every woman out there is going to, if I ran for office, I'm not going to be representing you, even though I'm or the women that believe what you believe. I'm not doing anything for them, and there's a lot of men out there who are doing what liberal women want. I think that gender loyalty, it's not that all women share the same views, therefore the only way for us to advance our agenda is to get more women in office. So it seems that that's a little bit antiquated for me. I do think we absolutely
but there's still that issue of testosterone and more than 90% of violent crimes done by men, and most war atrocities committed by men, and for that matter, most wars initiated by men. It doesn't. I mean, Maggie Thatcher may be the exception, you know, with the Falklands, but by and large, I think that it would not be inappropriate to say that we can lay at the feet of testosterone anyway, most of the violence, most of the death, the violent death in the history of the world.
I don't know what direction. If you have put a bunch of women in charge, that's not going to take away the fundamental problems we face and the struggles between nations. You think about what we're going on with right now in the war on terror. This is a fundamental difference of belief systems. I mean, are women, and when we talk about we need to make peace if there's somebody who thinks that you shouldn't exist or that
but
you're
white, women suicide bombers are very rare. Women mullahs are unknown.
Okay, sure, but do you think, I mean, if we had, let's just say we elected an all-female Congress and Hillary Clinton's president, I mean, does that mean that Iran is suddenly going to say, okay, we're no longer going to be we're no longer going to consider the United States an enemy.
No, I don't think so. But I think it might be that it might mean that we would be less likely to consider violence as the first course of action rather than
that
the last.
That may make us a whole lot weaker. You know, I think that we need to saying that we, if somebody goes in there and says,
I think what Reagan showed us in his confrontation with the Soviets is that talking works better than blowing people up.
But remember, he had a big threat. He was always said that, you know, we need to be ready to take action. Of course, nobody wants to go to war, but you can't totally shy away from that option of violence.
It's a fascinating topic to contemplate. Carrie Lucas, VP for the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org. Carrie, thanks for dropping
by.
Great.
Thanks so much for having me on, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. By the way, I should mention, Carrie Lucas, our last guest, wrote a piece over at townhall.com about this topic, and I failed to mention it in my discussion with her, and you can find that. It's called Don't Use Women to Justify Bad Economic Policy, and it's over at townhall.com. Last night, and you know, this is all apropos of, to some extent, I think, there are larger issues here. There are national issues. There are international issues. If we wanted to use an international news hook, the Prime Minister of Spain just appointed as his defense minister, the equivalent of Secretary of Defense for the country of Spain, a woman who is currently 7 months pregnant. And we're seeing increasingly in European countries large numbers of women involving themselves in politics, participating in politics, speaking out in politics, and it seems to have a salubrious effect, a positive effect. To bring that back to the more current, last night, Hillary Clinton, I would say, in many ways, handed Bill O'Reilly his head. And here we go.
You know, your husband and I make a lot of money. Did you know that?
I've heard that.
Yeah, we make a lot of money. And you, if you're president, are going to take more of my money and your husband's money away.
Now, see, not to pick on Hillary Clinton, because she really did take this. She does good at this kind of, you know, close-in knife fighting of debating, the kind of stuff that I do on this program, frankly. But there were a couple of things. Number one, obviously, Bill O'Reilly bragging. And he says, you want to take more of my money? Well, here's the thing. We have a nine-point-something trillion-dollar debt that works out to about $30,000 per person, including, like, newborn babies in the United States. So, Bill, when you have been part of the country that has spent and used that money, it's your debt. Which means that all your money ain't your money if we all agree that we're all going to pay taxes to cover these things, which we all agree to by every day that we stay in this country and say, no, I'm out of here. And the fact of the matter is that the argument for progressive taxation needs to be made, and needs to be made very clearly. What the cons say is, well, you know, it's my money and I get to keep it. Sorry, it's not. First of all, you're using the commons. You know, the example that I use is you walk into a 7-Eleven and you pick up a candy bar. At that point, that candy bar is still the property of the 7-Eleven, and the dollar in your pocket is still your property, right? But what if you tear it open, take a bite out of it? Who now owns that candy bar? And who now owns the dollar in your pocket? Even though you haven't walked up to the cash register. I guarantee you, if you were to walk out of that store without visiting the cash register, that our society and the police would say, sorry, that dollar in your pocket is not your money. It's the 7-Eleven's money. The candy bar is yours. You've used it. So then why progressive taxation? Why is it that somebody like Bill O'Reilly, who's making 5, 10, 15 million bucks a year, whatever he's making, why is it that he should pay a higher percentage of tax than somebody who makes $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year? And the answer is very simple. And Teddy Roosevelt, by the way, was the guy who laid this out, that people of great wealth acquire and maintain their wealth through a disproportionate use of the services of government. It's very straightforward. If, for example, a business person is, well, in the case of O'Reilly, he's got all these people who work on his show. He's probably got a staff of 20 or 30 people on his show. So you could argue that he's a business. If a business person is making, say, $1 million a year, they're making that money because there's a bunch of people who are working for them who are all, say, making $50,000 a piece, but each one of those people is generating wealth equal to $100,000 a piece, and O'Reilly's skimming some of that off the top because he's the guy out front or he's the one who's running the business. So the only way that people in America can successfully become wealthy is by taking some off the top from somebody else's labor, and that somebody else's labor had to be educated in the public workforce, has to get to work through the public transportation system, even using the public highways, is breathing fresh public air, is drinking clean public water. So the wealthy person's use of the commons is massively greater. Than the average person's use of the commons, because that's how they acquire their wealth. And once they seek to keep that wealth, to maintain that wealth, they're using the court system, they're using the banking system, they're using all the rules of the game. And by the way, they're typically paying a much lower tax right now with capital gains and dividends tax. And so their use of the commons is arguably even greater than that. I mean, I think we should roll back not only the Bush tax cuts, but we should roll back the Reagan and the Kennedy tax cuts and go back to what we have under the Eisenhower administration when we had a very, very strong middle class in the United States. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Slightly unbalanced here, the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. As John Gray of Cincinnati, Ohio, wrote in his iconic piece, A Day in the Life of Joe, Middle-Class Republican, Joe gets up at 6 in the morning to prepare his morning coffee, fills his pot full of clean drinking water because some liberal fought for minimum water quality standards. He takes his daily medication with his first swallow of coffee. His medications are safe because some liberal fought to ensure their safety, that they're safe and work as advertised. All but $10 of his medications are paid for by his employer's health plan because some liberal union workers fought their employers for paid medical insurance. And now Joe gets it, too. He prepares his morning breakfast, bacon and eggs today. His bacon is safe because some liberal fought for laws to regulate the meatpacking industry. Takes his morning shower, reaches for his shampoo. The bottle is properly labeled with every ingredient, the amount of its contents, because some liberal fought for him to have the right to know what he's putting on his body and how much of it is contained. He dresses, walks outside, and takes a deep breath. The air he breathes is clean because some tree-hugging liberal fought for laws to stop industries from polluting our air. He walks to the subway station for his government-subsidized ride to work. Saves him considerable money in parking and transportation fees. You see, some liberal fought for affordable public transportation, which gives everybody an opportunity to be a contributor in society. Joe begins his workday. He has a good job with excellent pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays and vacation, because some liberal union members fought and died for these working standards. If Joe's hurt on the job or becomes unemployed, he'll get workers' compensation or an unemployment check because some liberal didn't think he should lose his home just because of a temporary misfortune. Noon. Joe needs to go to the bank to deposit some money and some pay some bills. His deposit is federally insured by the FSLIC because some liberal wanted to protect Joe's money from unscrupulous bankers who ruined the banking system before the Republican Great Depression. He has to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and his below-market federal student loan because some stupid liberal decided that Joe and the government would be better off if he was educated and earned more money over his lifetime. What a novel idea. Joe is home from work. He plans to visit his father this evening at the family farm out in the country. Gets in his car for his drive to Dad's. His car is among the safest in the world because some liberal fought for car safety standards. He arrives at his boyhood home. He's the third generation to live in the house, financed by the Farmers Home Administration, because bankers didn't want to make rural loans. The house didn't even have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose in where it didn't belong and demanded rural electrification. Those rural Republicans will still be sitting in the dark otherwise and wouldn't have telephones. He's happy to see his dad, who's now retired. His dad lives on Social Security and his union pension because some liberal made sure he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to. After his visit with Dad, he gets back in his car for his ride home, turns on the talk radio show. The host keeps saying, liberals are bad and conservatives are good. He doesn't tell Joe that his beloved Republicans have fought against every single protection and benefit Joe enjoys throughout his day. Joe listens for a while and says, yep, we don't need those big government liberals ruining our lives. After all, I'm a self-made man who believes everyone should take care of themselves just like I have. Yeah. Thanks to John Gray for that. A little later on in the day, we'll share with you a day in the life of the true conservative. Just let me wrap up this, Hillary and Bill last night, and then we'll pick up your phone calls here. This, just to continue, Bill O'Reilly starts out going, I'm a rich guy. He's saying that he's a rich guy, and her husband's a rich guy, and she wants to take some of their money.
Away. Okay. Now I'm paying 33% Fed tax now. You're going to raise it to what?
I'm going up to what we had in the 1990s.
39 and a half. All right. 36, 39. All right, so I'm getting a 6.5% bump.
And so is Bill Clinton. It's only for the people making more than $250,000.
No, that's me. You're talking to them.
I know.
Okay.
And
so,
I am very happy that you're going to pay more so that we can cut middle class taxes on people who get up every day and do hard work that keep our country going.
But before I vote for you, I want to know exactly how much you're going to take out of my wallet, all right?
I'm going to take as much as you were paying in the 90s. And as I recall, you did pretty well in the 90s.
Bingo. So I, on balance, number one, I debated all day long, am I going to watch Fox? That was the biggest challenge for me, frankly, because I just have this thing about I just don't do that. But, I thought Hillary comported herself very well. I don't think she should have been on the show, but I thought she comported herself very well. Jerry in Burbank, California, listening on K-Talk in Los Angeles. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I want to comment on Carrie Lucas's remarks.
Mm-hmm.
I think Carrie Lucas is afraid of the implications of reality. I mean, you brought up the point of the Norwegians having 40% of their legislature female.
Right.
And that because women are present there in such a large number, they are able to change policy. They have steered the country towards peace.
Yes. Well, that was my point. I mean,
Wait a minute. Carrie says that women can participate, but what she doesn't want to have happen is for women to take over power from men. That's what she's afraid of, because men might get mad.
Well, I'm not sure it's because men might get mad.
I'm a woman. I know how this thing works.
Okay.
I mean, men's inherent violence has terrorized women for centuries.
Yeah. Yeah, there's
you get so you're afraid of men's anger. Anything men don't want to have happen. Some women are so terrorized of men that they put it out of their minds.
So you think that what Carrie was exhibiting was a variation on Stockholm syndrome, essentially?
Oh, sure.
Or
yes.
Battered wife syndrome. Interesting. Jerry, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Charles in L.A., also listening on K-Talk. Hey, Charles.
Yeah, I wanted to get into the politics, but since this moment your last caller said, I think people should boycott that Grand Theft Auto where it shows the guy just blowing off a woman's head for nothing.
Yeah, speaking of violence in our society.
there's a, and we need to speak out against that. There's a lot of violence that these major corporations promote in the video games and in the music, and as a society, we need to speak out against that.
Do you know who first developed those kinds of video games? It was the U.S. military as a training tool for soldiers to teach them how to kill.
Mm-hmm. That's the same. Now, Barack Obama, here you got a man, a good husband and wife. He was first candidate to come out in favor of the equal pay for women.
Right. And which he has been trashed for by the right.
Exactly, and I think he's an honest man. And you contrast that with Hillary, who said she was going to blow up Iran, obliterate Iran, and then yesterday she told another one of her fables, saying that this factory where Indiana lost a lot of jobs, the factory was a Chinese company bought the factory and moved it to China. Yeah. He said he blamed it on George Bush, but it turned out it was Bill Clinton that gave the okay on that.
Yeah, I know, and somehow she conveniently overlooked that. And this is one of the things, this is one of the problems with Hillary's candidacy, thank you, Charles, is that so many of the policies that were initiated by Reagan were followed through on by Clinton. And, you know, I mean, sure, the balanced budget, you know, although the fact of the matter is he lost both the House and the Senate to the Republicans during his presidency. And the Republicans like to take credit for that stuff. You know, you got Newt Gingrich going out there saying, hey, yeah, you know, me balanced the budget. Well, actually, spending originates in the House of Representatives. You could say the president proposes a budget, and Clinton proposed balanced budgets. And I think, actually, the one really pro-Clinton thing that you can say, and really say it correctly, is that he pushed through an increase in income taxes to get a balanced budget successfully without a single Republican vote, with all these Republicans on the floor of the House saying this is going to bring about the next Great Depression, this is going to be a disaster, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And instead it brought about prosperity. It actually was a positive thing, as we've seen in the past when taxes have gone up. Gail in Half Moon Bay, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Gail.
Hi, Tom. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you.
I'm calling to also respond to Kerry Lucas, because what that did was raise for me a current model in the world, in Bangladesh. I mean, Mohammed Yunus just received the Nobel Prize because he started the whole microlending phenomenon.
Right, with the Grameen Bank, or Grameen Bank, or however it's pronounced, yeah.
Oh, wow, I can't hear you very well.
I'm sorry about that.
But anyway, my point was he first started lending small amounts of money to men, and then he discovered they were spending it on themselves and not really changing society very much, and began to lend small amounts of money to women. And these very poor women are spending it on their communities and building community. And, I mean, so many people have now been lifted out of abject poverty in Bangladesh.
No, it's been tremendously successful. And, in fact, it's a model that's being created all around the world. Gail, spot on. Yeah, spot on and well said. Thank you. Nick in New Jersey, we've just got a minute before the break here. Nick, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'll try to be quick. Going back to the Hillary O'Reilly interview, it's significant because there was that one special moment that you played part of where you had two very rich people in the upper, what, 0.5%?
No, the upper one hundredth of 1%.
I'm throwing that out there, but yeah, frankly and openly talking money. It's like, well, you know, the subcontext was, well, you know, like I'm there too, and she says, yeah, I'm there too. What are we gonna do? You're trying to take that from me.
And then Dennis Miller comes on and says the same thing.
The whole thing, it's such a moral issue. You could take. Why doesn't one politician or wealthy person go on there and say, hey? Yeah, I'm in that bracket. Shoot, tax me for the good of all, 60, 70, 80%. Guess what? I'll still do pretty darn good.
That's right, and that's what Warren Buffett says. But I think the larger issue, Nick, is not even tax me to help others out. It's not like, you know, essentially the Marxist line. It's rather, as Teddy Roosevelt pointed out, those people of great wealth are disproportionately using the commons of this country and therefore should appropriately, proportionally pay for it. And that's why we have, that's one of the main reasons we have progressive taxation.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
right.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, supported in part by you, our listeners, supporting our local radio stations and our sponsors. Yeah, it really is important. And the Teamsters, Teamsters for Change. Speaking from behind the good old stainless steel working class microphone here, it's time for change in Washington. You can find out more at Teamster.org. We talked about Joe Republican a moment ago. How about the true Joe Conservative? What if the world really was the way the talk show hosts on the Reich suggest it should be? Well, this is, I don't know who wrote this one. Somebody else. But this is floating around. Joe Conservative wakes up in the morning, goes to the bathroom. This is a play on the Joe Republican, right? Goes to the bathroom. He flushes his toilet and brushes his teeth, mindful that each flush and brush costs him 43 cents to his privatized water provider. His wacky liberal neighbor keeps badgering the company to disclose how clean and safe the water is, but no one ever finds out. Just to be safe, Joe Conservative boils his drinking water. He steps outside and coughs. The pollution is especially bad today, but the smokiest cars are the cheapest ones, so everyone buys them. Joe Conservative checks to make sure he has enough toll money for the three different private roads he has to cross to get to work. No public transportation, so traffic is backed up, and his 10-mile commute takes an hour. On the way, he drops his 12-year-old daughter off at the clothing factory where she works. Paying for kids to go to private school until they're 18 is a luxury, and Joe really needs the extra income. Times are tough, and there's no social safety net. Gets to work 5 minutes late and misses the call for Christian prayer, and so he's immediately docked by his employer. He's not feeling well today, but he has no health insurance, since neither his employer nor the government provide it, and paying for it himself is just too expensive since he has a precondition. He just hopes for the best. His workday is 12 hours long because there's no regulation over working hours, and he'll lose his job if he complains or tries to unionize. Today's an especially bad day. His manager demands that he work until midnight, a 16-hour day. He does it knowing that he'll lose his job if he doesn't do it or if he complains. Finally, after midnight, he goes to pick up his daughter and go home. His daughter shows him the deep cut she got on the industrial sewing machine today. He's outraged and asks why she doesn't have metal mesh gloves or other protection. She says the company won't provide it, and she'll have to pay for it out of her own pocket. He looks at the wound and decides they'll have to use an over-the-counter disinfectant and bandages until it heals. She'll have a scar, but getting stitches at the emergency room is expensive. His daughter also complains that the manager made suggestive overtures toward her. Joe counsels her to be a good girl and not rock the boat, or she'll get fired and they'll be out of the income. His daughter says she can't wait until she's 18 so she can vote for change or go to the Iraq War. They get home, and there's a message from his elderly father who can't afford to pay his medical or heating bills. Joe can hear him coughing and shivering. He turns on the radio, and the top story is a proposal in Congress to raise the voting age to 25. A rare liberal opinionator states that it's an attempt to keep power out of the hands of working-class Americans. Conservative host immediately quashes him, calling him a utopian idealist and agreeing that people really aren't mature enough to make good choices until they're at least 25. Joe chuckles at the wine-swilling, cheese-eating liberal egghead and thinks, thank God I live in America where I have freedom. Yeah. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Barbara in Cave Creek, Arizona. Hey, Barbara, what's up?
Hi. Well, I just wanted to tell you, we all better get used to watching Fox, because the convention is going to be covered by Fox. And Hillary, of course, is on Fox because of her relationship with Murdoch. Geraldine Ferraro is a correspondent for Fox. So, I mean, this is, you know.
Yeah. You know, this is, in fact, one of our, I don't know if she wants me to mention her name, so I won't, but one of our station owners and I were talking about this a couple days ago, and she pointed out Fox is going to be providing the pool feed for the DNC, for the Democratic National Convention.
Right.
And, you know, on the surface, you'd think, gee, that's no big deal. They're just the ones that are pumping the video out. But the Fox board operator, video board operator, is the guy who's sitting there with a panel of 10 or 20 cameras, monitors all the cameras around the room that are showing. And he's the one who gets to decide when to go to the shot of the guy on stage versus when to go to the shot of the guy picking his nose versus when to go to the, you know, whatever. And it's just, you know, it's a bizarre situation. Apparently the DNC did not have the option of making this choice. Is that Sean, that's the understanding, that this was not, Sean talked with some folks at the DNC, and this was not their choice. I guess, you know, luck of the draw or however it works. But man, what a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, it's frightening. It's an abomination. I can't believe. Yeah, is it going to be run on C-SPAN? Because everybody need. If it is, we just need to watch C-SPAN.
Well, C-SPAN may have to take the feed from Fox, though.
Oh my God.
I mean, that's how. I don't know, but that's, you know, that could be how bad it is. I mean, it's just incredible. And somebody at Fox is going to say, okay, find somebody in the crowd who's nodding out, you know, as that person's giving the speech, or find somebody who's laughing inappropriately, or find the weirdest looking people you can. Oh, look at there, you know, and that's what they'll do. So.
Well, we better bring our own video cameras in. I mean, we're going to have to I film the whole convention so we can really see. You know, what are they going to do, cut off Obama in the middle of his speech?
It wouldn't surprise me at all. We're going to have to provide our own feed. Barbara, thanks for raising the issue. It's an important one. Nancy in Everett, Washington. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, Tom. I'm kind of all over the map here. Well, I've been listening to people talk, but the two callers at the beginning of the show were mentioning women from two extreme sides of the continuum. You had the women in Scandinavia. Was it Scandinavia?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay,
we're about half of all power positions are held by women.
And then you've got Hillary Clinton on the other end. And I guess the thing, have you read Mother Nature, Susan Blatterherty?
No, I have not.
Quality versus quantity. She basically does a gender thing where mainly it's women are for quality and men are for quantity as far as reproduction is concerned.
Yeah, but, yeah. And Rhianne Eisler also has addressed those issues in many of her books, The Chalice and the Blade and others. She's brilliant on these topics.
It's been a while since I've read anything on the testosterone effects, but I seem to recall that there was a study on football players that after they won the game, that's when the levels went up and the loser's testosterone levels went down.
That's correct. And it's not just football. It's right across the board. Nancy, I'm sorry we're out of time, but it is right across the board. The testosterone levels. But that's instantaneous change. There's still the levels, even among the losers, are higher than among women. Just, you know, because of the biological differences. So, you know, do we really want the people responsible for most of the murder in the world and most of the violent crimes in the world to be running the world? Could that have something to do with it?
Tom Hartman. Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Well, gender is apparently an issue. Well, apparently, gender is an issue in the elections right now. The issue of illegal immigration has been rather quiet recently. Or as I prefer to refer to it, our illegal employer problem. But it will come back, and it will come back big, because there are some very large and powerful interest groups involved in this. We have with us Zach Taylor. He's a former U.S. Border Patrol officer, now with the National Association of Former Border Patrol Officers, which is the NAFBPO, their website, nafbpo.org, who has recently testified before Congress on this issue. Zach Taylor, welcome to the program.
How you doing there, Tom?
I'm doing very well, thank you very much. I noticed in your testimony that you made the point that there's some things here I want to agree with you and some I want to disagree with you on, okay? And let's have a conversation about this. That you made the point that that Arizona has dealt with the problem of illegal immigration in a fairly successful way by simply penalizing employers, and that seems to be, you didn't explicitly say more effective than a fence, but that was, I got that from your testimony. Did I read that accurately?
Yes and no. The thing about Arizona that needs to be brought up is that these were referendums that were put on the ballot, and that the people actually voted on them statewide. And the particular one about which everybody was thinking wouldn't pass, actually got 84% nod from the voters.
Right.
So apparently there's a big disconnect or some disconnect between the popular thought of what the people are thinking and actually what they'll vote on.
Yeah, well, the point that I've been making for a long, long time is that we've had for, you know, 100 years, more or less, an open border with Mexico, and for 200 years, an open border with Canada, and it's never much been an issue. And in large part, it's never been much an issue because labor unions represented 25% of the workforce, and they worked very hard to make sure that people were actually citizens before they could get a job. You got labor unions down to now 7% of the private workforce. That influence is gone, and as a consequence, as you pointed out in your testimony, you've got big corporations going down to Mexico saying, recruiting people, going into towns where there's people who are particularly good at being meat packers or particularly good at being carpenters or whatever it may be, recruiting people and even offering to pay the cost of the smugglers to get them into the United States.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a common practice in the mid-90s, right up until I retired in 03.
Yeah, and presumably it's still going on.
Presumably, yeah, because it seemed to work.
Yeah.
It cut down on the lag time between when they needed an employee and when they got him.
Right. So what we have is U.S. corporations who, when they need cheap labor, incredibly cheap labor, and the manufacturing can be done outside the United States, they simply move the factory to China or Vietnam or someplace else where the labor is very cheap. And when they have stuff that needs to be done in the United States, they got a house that has to be built here, or they've got meat that needs to be processed here, and there's simply no way around it, they go down to Mexico or other South American countries and help smuggle people in. And this, of course, as David Ricardo in 1814 pointed out in his brilliant treatise on labor, as the supply of labor increases above the demand for labor, the cost of labor will fall to subsistence levels. And that's one of the things that is happening.
Right. The two things that really impacted it more than anything else is the ability of the people in the Central Americas in particular to travel.
Yeah.
Their access to our
Well, not so much to travel and work, because anybody can come through the border and say, I'm here on a tourist visa pretty much,
right.
Can't they?
The point is that the transportation system in Central America is much better than it was, and the transportation once you cross the border in the United States is it is really substantial.
Right.
And people can, by automobile, by bus, by many different means, get to where they're going.
Right. So what we're seeing is the exploitation of both the American workforce, whose middle class lifestyle is being destroyed, and the South and Central American workforce, who are being torn from their communities and having this carrot dangled in front of them that may end up being a false, in many cases, ends up being a false carrot. But then there's this third issue and that I wanted to talk with you about. There is legislation before the House and Senate to designate the borders with Canada and with Mexico as wilderness areas.
Right.
There are a number of species, including some big cats down in the south, that must cross that border in order to go from their feeding range to their mating range, from their summer range to their winter range. And if there is a fence, if that area is heavily patrolled, if there's the equivalent of a highway built in there or things like that that would make it, frankly, easier for Border Patrol officers to catch people, then it's going to wipe out these species. What's wrong with, and you testified against this legislation, saying that it would require people to be Border Patrol officers like you were to be on horseback or on foot. You can get a hell of a lot done on horseback, sir.
You can. That is true. But the problem is, if you could see this area, if you were to make this wilderness, then the bad guys would hold the high ground. And when you hold the high ground in a tactical situation, you control the situation.
Well, it depends on how many there are.
Well, yes. And then if it becomes attractive to the smuggler to move in and set up operations, they virtually destroy any place they move into.
Right, but this brings us back to the point that if American corporations stopped hiring people, we would have an exodus going south, not an in whatever the word is, not a migration going north.
Well, yes, if the entire problem revolves around the employment availability in the United States to the illegal worker. That's
right. So
if we
stopped that and said, hey, you know, if you're going to hire illegal people who are not citizens of the United States and you're going to hire them, you yourself, the CEO of the company, your butt's going to get tossed into jail, number one. And number two, if we designated these areas as a wildlife area. And number three, if we beefed up the Border Patrol and got them a whole lot more horses, so that we could protect the endangered species that are participating in, you know, that have to cross the border, Then really the only problem that you'd have is crime, criminals who are crossing the border. Because pretty much anybody else, they're going to go to a border crossing point with a visa and say, hi, I'm a visitor, I'm coming through.
Well,
right?
Well, yes and no. And if you'll think about working the border, now understand the New Mexico and Arizona border is relatively flat, where in Texas you have the Rio Grande River for a lot of the distance.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, if you'll think about playing football, and your defense depends on moving up and down the line in response to what the offense is doing, you have to have options and tools available to you for when the game changes and the play goes to a different area. You have to have something, some tools that you can go in there and apply to stop it.
And well, even in a wilderness area, you can bring in a helicopter.
Nope.
You can't.
Nope. Can't fly over it.
Well, we do that constantly here in the Pacific Northwest. People get lost hiking, climbing mountains and things. You bring in a helicopter, you find them.
We have, if you'll read the Wilderness Act of 1964, that would require waivers. And the act itself, if you read it, it doesn't even allow a bicycle to go in there. And we've had instances. It depends on how strictly the act is enforced.
Then instead of simply turning the border area into pavement and having this horrible impact on the environment, why not increase the number of waivers available for that sort of thing and make it so that the Border Patrol people can go in with bicycle. Actually, you know, I still like the idea of horses. I mean, you know, they even fertilize the soil as they go through, you know.
Well, actually, in Arizona, that's the problem. And the reason it's a problem is because of aggressive grasses that are spread by horse droppings into these sensitive areas, especially the Oregon Pipe and Cabeza Prieta Monument area.
Wouldn't it be worse, though, to have the, you know, the equivalent of a strip a half an acre wide paved with concrete?
Well, what happened, especially in Cabeza Prieta, when the law enforcement presence withdrew, is the smugglers, the drug smugglers in particular, took over the area and have completely demolished it.
The other thing you pointed out is that there are these rape trees. We only have 20 seconds left. Tell us about this.
It is a place where the smugglers that bring in the aliens and or the bandits that work the area waylay or stop the groups they're bringing in, take the females, and physically assault and rape them. And then they take their underwear and hang it up on trees to mark the area.
And you said that there's like these active. I mean, this is just horrific. And again, we can get back to the people are just trying to make a living. In most cases, these are not criminals or drug smugglers, and we need to stop U.S. employers from encouraging this. Zach Taylor, he's a former Border Patrol agent, NAFBPO.org. Zach, thanks for dropping by today.
Sure, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Minutes past the hour. Let me just make it perfectly clear where I stand on this whole issue. I am in favor of immigration, legal immigration. I think that our immigration policies are a disaster. We need to expand the number of people that we will allow to legally immigrate into the United States. My sister-in-law is a legal immigrant right now, working on her citizenship. Has been for 5-6 years. I mean, I've had to go down and testify to the INS. I mean, I'm very familiar with the drill. Immigration, immigrants have been the lifeblood of this country. They have provided for the diversity in this country. They have helped the culture of this country since its inception. Although I suppose most Native Americans might disagree with that, broadly speaking, you know, the first illegal immigrants really screwed things up from their point of view. But you know, setting aside that, which is, on some days is very difficult to set aside, but nonetheless, where we are right now, the problem is, not legal immigration. That's something, as I said, needs to be fixed. I mean, it's a crime that we allowed 5,000 Iraqis after we destroyed their country. You've got, you know, 10, 12, 13-year-old girls in Iraq from Iraq who are working in Syrian brothels right now. Syria has become, southern Syria has become the sex capital of the Middle East. People, you know, these brothels, all the license plates are from Saudi Arabia. People driving over there from Saudi Arabia for basically sex with kids. I mean, it's horrible what we have done to Iraq. 2.5 million external refugees, 2 million internally displaced refugees, the second largest, arguably the first largest, refugee crisis in the world, behind Darfur or in front of Darfur, depending on whose numbers you're using. And that we only allow 5,000 Iraqis into the United States after we did that. That there are people around the world who are refugees from oppression. That there are people who would like to flee China because they've been politically active, and instead they're being imprisoned and executed, and their organs being transplanted to wealthy people from largely from the Middle East who go over there to buy a liver. I mean, there are a lot of good reasons why we should expand our immigration quotas. At the same time, the issue of illegal immigration, in my opinion, is not an issue of illegal immigration. We don't have an illegal immigration problem in this United States. We have an illegal employer problem. We have a problem of basically rich white guys and the corporations that they control, exploiting, by and large, people of color. And then saying to the average American, look out, the brown people are coming, oh my God, whipping up the fear, which drives those people even further underground, the people that they're smuggling into this country, that they're importing into this country in many cases, that they're exploiting, that they're hiring, and then saying, well, you know, the American people are a little PO'd at you right now. You better keep your head down and be sure not to complain when I only pay you $3 a day or I don't pay you at all. I mean, you get it? How the whole system is being gamed. It's all about the man. Just like it always has been, frankly. And this is why labor unions, democracy in the workplace, has always been one of the strong remedies, and has ever since the deconstruction of labor in the United States, we've been seeing these problems. Ronald Reagan did two things that led directly to this situation right now. When he came into office, 25% of all workers in the United States were members of unions. 25%, a quarter of the workforce. For every unionized job, there's another nearly identical job in terms of pay and benefits and worker participation in the workplace. Just because companies have to compete with the unionized companies for the workers. So that meant that about half of the American workforce had all the pay and benefits and rights and powers of a union job when Reagan came into office. Now it's down to 7% of the private workforce. So that was the first bulwark against employers exploiting people the way that employers are exploiting people who aren't even Americans now. And the second was in, what was it, 83, 86? I think maybe it was 86. Reagan did an amnesty and for people who are in the country illegally. Why? Because it helped out his big corporate contributors. Hey, here's cheap labor. And over the short term, you know, you could argue this was a reasonable thing to do. We do have to come up with a rational policy for this, a rational basis for this. We've got a lot of people in this country who have children who are U.S. citizens. We've got people who have come to this country who are not citizens who have married U.S. citizens. It's cruel and crazy to say we're simply going to do one cookie-cutter solution. We're going to tear apart families. We're going to send, you know, dad south, but mom stays here, or the other way around, and the kids are going to go into foster care. I mean, these are horrific solutions. We need reasonable, rational, positive solutions to the problem of people who have come to the United States because the employers, because the rich white guys in their corporations have said, hey, we got a job for you, come on over. We need to address that. We need to address it honestly. We need to have a reasonable debate about it, free of demagoguery, free of all the subtext of, oh my God, it's the brown people coming, free of all the racism implicit in it. We need to have that conversation, and we need to come up with a solution. And I think that the Democrats, and frankly even John McCain, have come close to some reasonable solutions in that regard. But let's recognize this for what it is. This is an illegal employer problem. This is an exploitation of labor problem. We need to re-empower labor with card check, with the Employee Rights Act. We need to bring back the power of labor unions. We need to say to the Bush administration, sorry, you can't run the Labor Department as an anti-labor department. We have $1 billion a year industry in the United States devoted just to busting unions and helping corporations prevent having unions. $1 billion a year in consulting fees to corporations to how to keep unions out. I mean, This is all one fabric. And the end result, the end game of it, destroy the middle class, increase the number of poor, disempowered, politically disenfranchised people and workers in the United States, and massively increase the wealth at the top. That's the bottom line.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Everybody is familiar. Well, actually, probably everybody isn't familiar. Maybe it should be revisited. John Kennedy's thoughts on liberalism and why he was proud to be a liberal.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with the taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
Now, that was John Kennedy in 1960, running for president of the United States, saying that he is proud to be a liberal. Keep in mind, 4 years earlier, Dwight Eisenhower ran for president in 1956, and the Republican platform, the Republican Party platform, and a tip of the hat to Carl Wolfson, who does the morning show here on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, for sharing this with me. This is the Republican Party platform from 1956. President Eisenhower has given the world bold proposals for mutual arms reduction. We support his offer of U.S. participation in an international fund for economic development financed from savings brought by true disarmament. We shall continue vigorously to support the United Nations. Under the Republican administration, as our country has prospered, so have its people. As President Eisenhower said, labor is the United States. The men and women who, with their minds, their hearts, and hands, create the wealth that is shared in this country, they are America. The Eisenhower administration has brought to our people the highest employment, the highest wages, and the highest standard of living ever enjoyed in the nation. The federal minimum wage has been raised for more than 2 million workers. This is the Republican platform. Has been raised for more than 2 million workers. Social Security has been extended to an additional 10 million workers, and the benefits raised for 6.5 million. The protection of unemployment insurance has been brought to 4 million additional workers. The Eisenhower administration has enforced more vigorously and more effectively than ever before the laws which protect the working standards of our people. Our workers have gained and unions have grown in strength and responsibility, have increased their membership by 2 million. The Republican action created the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare as the first new federal department in 40 years to raise the continuing consideration of these problems for the first time to the highest council of government, the president's cabinet. And this is the Republican platform? It goes on about our national parks and let's Teddy Roosevelt's legacy and we're all America. And in fact, Eisenhower himself, speaking before the American Society of Newspaper Editors, pointing out explicitly that the cost of a battleship is paid for in food.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed.
Now, you get it? John Kennedy and Dwight Eisenhower were both, to a large extent, liberals. What has happened is that the Republican Party has been hijacked by crazies. These people aren't even conservatives. They're crazies. Eisenhower continued.
Those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of his children.
And then he talks about the cost of this arms race.
The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
This is no way of life at all? This is a Republican president! This is the Republican president whose campaign ad. I mean, just imagine if John McCain were to run a campaign ad like this. This is Dwight Eisenhower's campaign ad in the 1952 election.
Eisenhower knows how to deal with the Russians. He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us.
With us.
Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace.
Vote for peace?
Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Vote for peace? This is a Republican? Don't you get how far America has come in this post-Limbaugh, post-Reagan era from the traditional understanding that we had of who we are as a people and what we're all about? That's just incredible. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Kathy in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Kathy.
Oh, hi, Tom. I've been on hold for a while, so I'm afraid I'm off subject at this point.
That's
but
okay.
Last week, I watched a program on some cable show about a camera crew that had followed around a cult leader and their group. And then the next day, you talked about Rush Limbaugh calling for riots at the Democratic convention.
Well, he wasn't calling for them. He was dreaming of them.
Oh, dreaming of them. Okay.
Yes.
Well, this
to the tune of I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Mm-hmm. This cult leader would get messages from God, things that he would claim he didn't want to do, and it was a great sacrifice for him to have this happen, and he was giving up his life to do this.
Right.
And these messages quite often had something to do with consummating relationships with different female members in the group. And he would either lecture about them or send them off as emails. And then later, these people would get this light bulb message from God, and it would turn out to be what this cult leader had asked for. But they wouldn't remember that he had said that.
Right.
They would think
Kathy, your point is what?
My point is, I think it would be really interesting to have a psychologist on to talk about Rush Limbaugh and how this relates to...
As a cult leader. Yeah, that's an interesting one. Thank you, Kathy. I mean, I would submit to you that Dittoheadism is a cult. And in fact, over on our website, we have the 12-step program for recovering conservatives. And, you know, one of these days on the show, we'll just walk through those 12 steps for those of you who are recovering conservatives. It's possible. You can make it. You can actually make it through. Fred in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Fred, what's up?
Hey, I'd like to talk about injustice and how it pervades the statements of Bill O'Reilly taking disproportionate credit for all of his money and away from the commons, as well as these corporate people for saying that corporations disproportionately, at least they say, they create jobs, as well as people saying that... the problem of immigration is disproportionately the caused by, let's say, the employers
right.
or the actual immigrants.
The simple reality, Fred, is that no corporation has ever created a job. In my lifetime, I've created 7 large successful corporations. We've built up and sold off a couple of them. Actually, 2 of them are nonprofits. They're still running. I'm still on the board. And have hired and you know employed and supervised and made money off of hundreds of employees. I never created a job. What I did was I saw things where I could provide a product or a service to a marketplace, to people who wanted to pay for it, and I hired people to make that product or do that service, and I paid them less than I was able to charge for it, and I was able to skim something off the top and put it in my pocket. That's called being an entrepreneur, being a business owner, and if I did it with my own money, and usually I did, it's called being a capitalist. And you know, that's how the system works. I never created a job. I hired people. We need to change the paradigm in America. It is labor that creates the wealth. I didn't create the wealth. It was the people working for me who created the wealth.
Tom, you know this, and a lot of your listeners know this, but the people who are suckered all the time by mainstream media do not know this, and when they are told that it's their fault for getting subprime mortgages, and it's their fault for their kids listening to Miley Cyrus and Britney Spears.
Or worse, it's their fault for getting laid off.
Of injustice that happens when people think that it's the corporations create jobs and
yeah, exactly. It's when they say it's their fault for getting laid off. I mean, it's like, you just need more education. That's what you need. You should have gotten your PhD back then. You know, it's those jobs are just going away and they're never coming back. Come on, give me a break. It is. We're seeing the transformation of America. I mean, it's just 5 million Americans have slipped into poverty since Bush became president. 7 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Median household income has gone down $1,300 per household since Bush became president. And this is a trend that started under Reagan with Reaganomics that Bush is continuing. 3 million manufacturing jobs lost. 3 million American workers lost their pensions. Home foreclosures are the highest on record since the Republican Great Depression. A personal savings rate is zero. It's below zero. It's actually negative. We haven't seen that since 1931, since the depths of the Great Depression. The real cost of college is exploding, and the rich are getting richer.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Simple-minded and the uninformed can be easily led astray. And those that cannot connect the dots, hey, look the other way. People believe what they want to believe when it makes no sense at all. So be careful of those who kill in Jesus' name. You don't believe in killing at all. Walk tall.
Yeah, you don't believe in killing at all? I just have to share with you one last, this is very, very short, one last thought from Dwight Eisenhower.
There can be no enduring peace for any nation.
Let me just set this up before we restart it. This is Dwight Eisenhower speaking at the 1964 Republican Convention, the convention that nominated Barry Goldwater. And it was a rather controversial speech, actually.
There can be no enduring peace for any nation while other nations suffer privation, oppression, and a sense of injustice and despair.
No applause.
In our modern world, it is madness to suppose that there could be an island of tranquility and prosperity in the sea of wretchedness and frustration.
And he was greeted with polite applause, but that was about it. Steve in Monterey, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Steve.
Tom, that tells me Ike wasn't in on JFK's hit anyway.
No.
But no, I called about that border guard bringing up the foxism of illegal immigration.
Right.
I'm calling. I'm listening to you on KRXA in Monterey, but I live in Watsonville. It's a farm community that's maybe 90% Hispanic, and I talk to people across the years. You know. And what I heard was that a good percentage of them people that are so-called illegal immigrants are those who have overstayed their visas.
Right.
And the remainder fit into the category of what you're talking about from Iraq. They are refugees.
Yeah, in many cases, and to a large extent, they're refugees from U.S. foreign policy, U.S. economic foreign policy.
It's, right.
Yeah, we're exporting corn at such a cheap price that we're driving people in Central and South America, small subsistence farmers, off their land because they can no longer afford to sell their own corn.
How different is it from when in Ireland the British were taking all the crops and shipping them off to Britain, and the Irish were standing there starving to death on the
docks,
you know, waiting to get on board what amounted to a slave ship.
No, you're absolutely right, and I don't think most Americans know that story. By the way, the fact that during the 3 years of the Irish potato famine.
Correct.
In the 1854 to 58 or whatever
it
was.
46 to 49.
46 to
49.
Thank you very much. You're probably right. But during the time of the potato famine, when you had that fungus that was destroying the potato crops, every single one of those years, Ireland exported more food to England than they would have needed to feed all of their people because the English owned the land. And I think that it's a great metaphor. It's a great metaphor. And we have to recognize that this is not a simple problem as some of the folks who would demagogue this issue or some of the folks who would hypersimplify it, be they Sam Brownback or be it Lou Dobbs or whatever, as these guys would say, oh, you know, it's just people trying to get more money, or it's just people, you know, trying to come to America because life is good, or it's just people who are, you know, trying to gain this. Our policies, NAFTA, for example, has increased poverty in Mexico. NAFTA was supposed to build the Mexican middle class. It didn't. NAFTA has increased poverty. Now, NAFTA has also allowed Mexico to have their first six billionaires.
Just shows you freedom and free trade are not equatable.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to question, are you aware that there's a chapter in Das Kapital by Karl Marx, the London Times columnist of the time, on Ireland?
I don't recall. You know, it's been 25 years since I read Das Kapital.
Well,
so,
it's way toward the end, but he does seriously address, like, you know, what the British landlord system was doing to these people. And it was all, like, you know, because, oh, well, we have legislative fiat coming from Parliament, therefore, you know.
Yeah. I got it. And well said, Steve. Thank you very much. Arlen in Lakewood, California, you want to spend your tax rebate on something?
Yes, I do. I was hoping that you might be able to give me some good advice regarding what organization I might be able to submit that to.
In order to do what?
Well, I'm wanting to submit it for investigation toward the administration for impeachment.
The crimes of the administration? The Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner's organization, is doing great work. The National Lawyers Guild is doing great work. The American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, I'm a proud card-carrying member of, is doing great work. Those are three that immediately come to mind. And then, of course, there's the social movements, you know, from MoveOn.org to Democracy for America, to Democrats for America. I mean, there's a whole variety of them. Or you can simply pick an individual candidate and say, this is a person who has a high probability of making it to Congress who can really make a difference. And even at the local level, I wouldn't underestimate the power of supporting local folks and getting them out there and getting them involved. It's a great thing to do. Today's May Day, by the way, as Anthony in Seattle wants to remind us. Hey, Anthony.
Yes, Tom, everything you've talked about this morning is culminating in Seattle today. As far as the immigration, there's going to be a humongous immigration rally like the ones we've seen in years past. And so Seattle is going to be just total gridlock. The International Longshoremen Workers Union will be striking up and down the West Coast because they went to their employer to ask for today off to protest the Iraq war, and they were told no. And so now they're just, all the longshoremen are just calling off today.
Now, is that an authorized stoppage, or is it just a wildcat?
It's a wildcat. It's a wildcat.
Yeah, that was my understanding, yeah.
It's all going to be converging at Pier 66 today here in Seattle. The other thing is on the topic of the commons, in regard to our ports, we in Seattle are taxed. We receive a tax, or we pay a tax as far as the ports are concerned. So when these huge tanker ships from China pull up to our ports,
Anthony, you're breaking up badly. I'm sorry, your cell phone is shot. Plus, we're out of time. But I get your point that it is all of our collective property, and maybe you wanted to make a point beyond that. Anyhow, it's 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, the fifth anniversary of Mission Accomplished. What shall we do?
Tom
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, we've talked about how today is May Day. It's the anniversary. You know, when I was a little kid, long time ago, we had the maypoles. I remember maypoles in elementary school. They used to, you know, it was just this whole thing of it was basically a pagan ceremony. I mean, it was, hey, spring is here. And I thought they were just, you know, it was a cool thing. I mean, they didn't teach us, hey, it's a pagan ceremony, but, you know, and ring around the rosy and all this stuff. And, but it was also the International Labor Day. It was adopted by the socialists and the communists. And it was also at one time an International Day of Peace. So, but for most of recent American history, May 1st May Day had been a day associated with labor. Until the red baiting of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it was strongly associated with labor. And so, of course, what better way to take attention away from that than on May 1st to declare victory in a war on terror? George W. Bush on the USS Abraham Lincoln on this day 5 years ago.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Now, what's even more interesting is what he continued to say after that.
The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001.
See, there it is again. I told you how when Congress authorized him to use force against Iraq, the caveats were that the UN had to be exhausted, and it wasn't. Resolution 1441 was never fulfilled. And that he had to certify to Congress that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. And here he's doing it again. And here we are 5 years later. Is it time now to use this anniversary, this May Day anniversary, as a reminder of the crimes of the Bush administration and a serious time to consider the impeachment of this man and his colleagues so that he cannot pardon himself? My understanding is that if Bush is actively under impeachment by the House of Representatives, forget about whether the Senate will vote on it. Forget about whether it's even a successful vote. If he is in the process of being impeached by the House of Representatives, he cannot pardon himself. If other high members of his administration, such as Cheney, are in the process of being impeached, they cannot pardon themselves. Congress has to withdraw the impeachment motion, as it did in the case of Richard Nixon, in exchange for leaving office. Frankly, I don't think they should do that. I think they should follow through with it. I think the whole let's cut Richard Nixon some slack was a huge mistake. But look at these, vote2impeach.org and impeachbush.org. These websites have on them the articles of impeachment. There's a variety of them out there that have been put together by a number of different people. This is one of the best over at impeachbush.org. President, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office. This is from Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution. Shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And so, this suggestion is that George W. Bush, Richard B. Cheney, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez have committed numerous violations and subversions of the Constitution of the United States in an attempt to carry out with impunity crimes against peace, against humanity, and war crimes and deprivations of the civil rights of the people of the United States and other nations, by assuming powers of an imperial executive accountable to law and usurping powers of the Congress, the judiciary, and those reserved to the people of the United States. And then they go through the articles of impeachment. And number one, seizing power to wage wars of aggression in defiance of the U.S. Constitution. Carrying out a massive assault on an occupation of Iraq, a country that was not threatening the United States. lying to the people of the United States, to Congress, and to the United Nations, providing false and deceptive rationales for war. Number three, authorizing, ordering, and condoning direct attacks on civilians, civilian facilities, and locations where civilian casualties were unavoidable. Number four, instituting a secret and illegal wiretapping and spying operation against the people of the United States through the National Security Agency. And I would add the complicity of a number of telephone companies, although not all of them. Number five, threatening the independence and sovereignty of Iraq by belligerently changing its government by force and assaulting Iraq in a war of aggression. Number six, authorizing, ordering, and condoning assassinations, summary executions, kidnappings, secret and other illegal detentions of individuals, torture, and physical and psychological coercion of prisoners to obtain false statements concerning acts and intentions of governments and individuals and violating within the United States, and by authorizing U.S. forces and agents elsewhere the rights of individuals under the 1st, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 8th Amendments to the Constitution of the United States, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. This is just the beginning. We're up to six now. Seven, making, ordering, and condoning false statements and propaganda about the conduct of foreign governments and individuals and acts by U.S. government personnel. And here we just saw this being outed by the New York Times last week. And in fact, Dana Perino, finally somebody from the media asked Dana Perino about it. Here's this from the press conference yesterday.
Go ahead. The New York Times has reported that over the last... over the last 6 years, the Pentagon conducted a secret operation designed to sell the war in Iraq and the war on terror to the American people. It recruited more than 75 ex-military officers, many with financial ties to the defense industry.
As this guy is citing his points, Dana Perino is standing there going,
Provided them with talking points and an extraordinary degree of access not available to ordinary members of the press, including meetings with the Secretary of Defense, and it got them hired as supposedly independent military analysts by every U.S. television network.
Now, at this point, she's like, oh, wait a minute, now you're talking about our corporate buddies? I don't think I can let this go on.
One of its participants described the program... One of its participants described the program as psyops on steroids, and others said that...
Is this your opinion? No, I'm reading from the reporting of the New York Times, Dana.
Describing the program. Others said that if they departed from the Pentagon's talking points, their access was cut off. And my question is, did the White House know about and approve of this operation?
And now listen to the song and dance.
Look, I didn't know... I think that you guys...
I'm not a war criminal. You know, I realize that the Nuremberg tribunals put people to death. I wasn't here then. It wasn't my fault.
How about and approve of this operation?
Look, I didn't know... I think that you guys should take a step back and look at this operation. Look, DOD's made a decision. They've decided...
Okay, it's all the Department of Defense's fault. Blame it on Don Rumsfeld. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dana. Number eight, violations and subversions of the Charter of the United States and international law, both a part of the supreme law of the land under Article 6, Paragraph 2 of the Constitution. He broke the law. Acting to strip, number nine, acting to strip United States citizens of constitutional and human rights, ordering indefinite detention of citizens without access to counsel, without charges, and without opportunity to appear before a court. Number 10, ordering indefinite detention of non-citizens of the U.S. and elsewhere and without charges at the discretionary designation of the Attorney General or the Secretary of Defense. This is all illegal. Do you get it? This is all illegal. Number 11, ordering and authorizing the Attorney General to override judicial orders. Number 12, authorizing secret military tribunals and summary execution of people. Number 13, refusing to provide public disclosure of the identities and locations of persons. We didn't even tell the Red Cross. This is a violation of international law. This is what we prosecuted the Nazis for at Nuremberg. Number 14, use of, among other things, obviously their crimes were far more horrific than what Bush has done. And these crimes rise to the level of being worthy of international prosecution. We've got 4.5 million refugees in Iraq, over 100,000 people, maybe as many as 1 million people dead in Iraq as a consequence of these lies perpetrated by this administration. Number 14, use of secret arrests of persons within the United States and elsewhere, and denial to the right of public trials. 15, authorizing the monitoring of confidential attorney-client privileged communications. 16, authorizing and ordering the seizure of assets. 17, engaging in criminal neglect in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. 18, institutionalization of racial and religious profiling and domestic spying. 19, refusal to provide information and records necessary for the appropriate constitutional right of legislative oversight for going around the Congress of the United States. And 20, rejecting treaties protective of peace and human rights and abrogations of the United States under international treaties and obligations without the consent of the legislative branch. Time to nail them. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
Minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jim in New York City. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking the call. I was listening. It's mind-boggling the amount of crimes that have been committed, but I think for an honor of Bush's anniversary of 5 years in Iraq, that a drive can be, I'm thinking of ways of getting this out on mainstream television, not cable, but all the crimes listed with appropriate video in honor of him, and make collection across the nation. There's so many people fed up with this, wanting him out of office. You can get millions of dollars by doing a drive.
This would be a great project for MoveOn.org. Excellent, excellent suggestion, Jim. Thank you very much. Laird in Eureka, California. Hey, Laird.
Hi. First, a footnote on something a woman said yesterday. She was talking about soldiers' trauma during the Civil War.
Right.
And
soldier's heart, she referred to it as.
Right, and there was also a thing called soldier's disease, which was morphine addiction.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Anyway, what I called about was, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be better to forget all of the international tribunals and forget all the rest of the stuff that goes with war crimes and simply try and prosecute under the federal acts, the RICO acts specifically.
Because I've explored this and actually spent some time looking over the RICO acts. And here's the problem. The RICO acts are very narrowly constructed. They specify a series of ranges of crimes that they can be used against, and they can't be used against anything except those things because they provide extraordinary police and somewhat extrajudicial powers to the government. Basically, they can only be used for organized crime. Originally they were put together to prosecute the mob and mob's influence and everything from unions to the
right.
Food industry.
Right. Of course, now they're used against gang members in L.A. and
Right. And which still fall under the purview, frankly, of the RICO acts. I think that it would be a stretch. You could conceivably argue that you would have to successfully actually argue before you could invoke the RICO Act, that the Republican Party itself had become a criminal institution, a criminal organization, a criminal conspiracy.
Yeah.
I think that would be a stretch. That'd be
my whole thing is I would really like to see him come to justice here in this country.
I agree, and the remedy provided for that in the Constitution is impeachment.
All right,
thanks a lot for the call. It would be nice. Jeff in Orange County, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. Just to answer your question, is it time? Oh, God, so far beyond time. It's so far beyond time. I've actually stated before that I think if either one of our candidates would just run on this platform and maybe even use the terms dereliction of duty when they discuss Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid.
But they need to be, let me just say, though, Jeff, they need to be very careful. I remember Louise and I sitting on the couch watching Howard Dean on the Chris Matthews show 4 years ago.
Yep.
Excuse me. And Dean said that he thought the big media should be broken up. And Matthews gave him that horrified look and said, are you kidding? He said, you realize that we're on a network that's owned by General Electric, a big, multinational.
Definitely. That's why Jim's idea a moment ago was fantastic.
Well, let me finish this thought, if I may, Jeff.
Why do you not see a poll like that?
No, I get it. Let me just run down this thought. So as soon as Dean says that, And this was when he was at the peak of his popularity. The next day, I turned to Louise and I said, that's the end of his positive press coverage. The next day on the morning shows, they were asking the questions, is Howard Dean angry?
Oh, absolutely.
A couple of weeks ago, about a week and a half ago, Barack Obama made a public statement. We talked about it on this show, but I didn't see it covered in any of the corporate media. He made the public statement that he would not suspend investigations or prosecutions of members of this administration if he became president. And immediately thereafter, I would say the day thereafter, or within 2 days thereafter, all of a sudden Barack Obama was not the fair-haired boy, is the wrong, you know, those phrases imply race, but nonetheless, you get the point. He was no longer the favorite of the media, and all of a sudden it was like, maybe Hillary can win this thing. And I was saying, okay, Hillary Clinton, this is the question that I want everybody out there to ask Hillary Clinton. Will you continue the investigations into, and initiate, if they're appropriate, investigations into crimes committed by this administration? And if you find evidence of those crimes, will you prosecute people even though they're no longer in office? That's the question that I want to hear, because the question has been asked of Barack Obama, and he has said, yes, I will pursue those, and I will prosecute. I want to hear Hillary Clinton's take on that. And I have a feeling if she says, no, we'll let it go, that she will become, you know, the pressure from the media will become enormous for her to be the nominee. And if she says, we will prosecute, we will follow, you're going to see the media turn on both the Democratic candidates, and all of a sudden John McCain can do no wrong. Because and it's not because the media is the captive of the Republican Party. It's because they're like this. They're interrelated. It's like two hands with the fingers interlaced. The corporate media and the Republican Party, these big transnational corporations that in many cases have defense interests, and if they don't have defense interests, they have interlocking boards with companies that have defense interests, are the same companies that are providing our media. And they're the same companies that are paying our politicians. And they cannot tolerate, they will not allow it, because it won't just stop at George Bush and Don Rumsfeld. As the New York Times pointed out last week, it's going to go right to the corporate media, and the corporate media the television media, still has not reported on their complicity in these crimes of these 75 former military guys illegally spreading disinformation to the American people.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Trailer and another new gun. I'm a Republican now. Criticism deflects. I'm a Republican now. And nobody checks. I'm a Republican now. We still ain't having no sex. I'm holier than now. I'm a Republican now.
Oh, ain't it cool? Well, welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Christy Harvey's with us. She's the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress and the editor of MikeCheckRadio.org, AmericanProgress.org, MikeCheckRadio.org, the websites. Hey, Christy.
Hey, how are you today, Tom?
Just great. Great to have you with us. Before we get into the things that the Center for American Progress has been covering and that you've been working on, I just wanted to get your thoughts and opinions on this, because I'm getting an enormous amount of email about it.
Yeah.
Deborah Jean Palfrey, the D.C. madam, the one who caused David Vitter to nearly lose it, has been found dead, apparently,
yes,
in Florida,
she has.
An apparent suicide. And I'm of two thoughts on this. One is, I mean, she was in her 50s, and she was looking at 50 years in prison. She was awaiting sentencing. I'm in my 50s. If I was looking at 50 years in prison and awaiting sentencing, I would seriously be considering suicide, particularly given the state of our prisons today. On the other hand, there were a lot of people who had a lot to lose if she was to start talking a little bit louder. And, you know, this is something that could make the whole Vince Foster thing look like the stupidity it was. You know, I mean, the conspiracy theories. What's your take on this?
Well, I think, first of all, I think it's really sad. And we're still finding, the information is still coming out. She was found dead in a storage shed next to her mother's mobile home down in Florida. She was found with a couple of handwritten suicide notes near the body. And, Yeah, you're right. She was involved in this high-powered prostitution ring. She brought down the likes of Senator David Vitter from Louisiana and the former USAID chief, Randall Tobias. But I think, personally, it's just a little bit too soon for the conspiracy. I mean, of course, my mind went there first also. You know, oh, my gosh, can you believe it? This would, you know, if this were a movie, that would, of course, be what happened at the end.
Yep.
But also, I think that we also have to keep in mind that, you know, people who run prostitution rings and things like that aren't always known for being incredibly stable or for having the highest self-esteem or rational thought processes. So I think there's a lot that we're going to have to find out first before the conspiracy theories can really start to flow.
That's a very rational take on it, Christy.
I find it very sad, especially because, you know, she, of course, was guilty of money laundering and racketeering and the prostitution ring and things such as that. But the media also, you know, threw her into this spotlight, used her to make points against the, you know, Bush administration and conservative Republicans and people who deserved the points made against them. But I think that she was really used and abused by the media as well.
For their hypocrisy. She tried to fight back, they beat her down.
They beat her down and then they dropped her and ignored her when it was time for her to speak. So I think it's just a tragic story all the way around. But I have to say I am curious to see what the new developments will be.
Yep. 5 years ago today.
Oh, man. I think I'm grounded.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
And then he added, this is where it gets even weirder. Then he added,
the Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001.
How twisted is that?
It's bad. I've been in a terrible mood all day, and I realized I'm always in a bad mood on Mission Accomplished Day. I can't handle it very well. And especially this week, when things are still going so poorly in Iraq. And did you see that State Department report that came out yesterday about the state of the global war on terror, if you will? I hate
yes,
that phrase.
Yes, if you would go through the statistics for us.
Yeah, it's really bad, and it's really blood-chilling. The opening line from the ABC story that covered it said, quote, "Are we winning? Looking at the just-released State Department report on terrorism, the answer appears to be no." That's a pretty damning statement. That's pretty terrible.
Particularly when you consider that at the time assuming that the whole official story is accurate and this was Osama bin Laden and a small group of, you know, a small little merry band and 19 guys with box cutters and all that stuff, that at that time he had at most 20,000 followers.
Right.
20,000 people. And in the weeks following 9/11, virtually the entire Muslim world stood up and said, "We're with you, the United States." You know, we are from France saying, which is not a Muslim country, obviously, but from the Le Monde headline, "We're all Americans now," to the candlelight vigil in downtown Tehran, Iran, the day after 9/11. The entire Muslim world was repelled by this, was horrified by this. We had such an opportunity to bring the world together, and instead, we have now this guy. I mean, you can walk into any market in Jakarta or in Bangkok or in Bombay or even in some European countries,
right,
and find hot selling T-shirts with pictures of Osama bin Laden on
them. Well, exactly. And let me just give you a couple of the numbers. I won't wonk it out too hard, but a couple of the numbers that are in the State Department report. Last year, suicide bombings were up 50% from the year before.
This is worldwide.
This is worldwide. Also, last year, 66,995 people were either killed or wounded in terror attacks. And that's up from 59,000 in 2006 and 39,000 in 2005. So it's really showing that terrorism worldwide is getting worse. And it really just underscores the lie to the phrase that we're fighting them in Iraq so we don't have to fight them other places, which is what we heard for years and years and years. We have to fight them there so we don't fight them here. We're, you know, making Iraq the front on the war on terror so that there is an actual place to fight. And,
right,
you know, we knew it wasn't true, but now we've got these scary numbers to back it up. And two of the other things that are in the report that I think are really important for everybody to know and to talk about. One is that the terrorists, says the State Department, have gotten much, much more efficient. thanks to the war in Iraq and things like that, they've figured out how to kill us better and how to kill more of us with less supplies. They've gotten very efficient, for example, with the suicide bombs and have figured out how to do it in a way that causes the most damage and the most terror. And, you know, you and I have talked about how Iraq is basically grad school for wannabe terrorists. And that's one of the reasons that being over there in this extended war has been so bad.
Yeah.
And then the other thing. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and being over there in this extended war, we've got like defense contractors like DynCorp. You know, a defense contractor was killed because he went out on a high-risk mission in an unsecured car. Where was his armored car?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, this came out from a whistleblower this week. He's sent out on a dangerous mission in a car that doesn't have armor because DynCorp contractors, our federal contractors, were using the armored car to go pick up hookers in Kuwait.
And bring them into Baghdad for their employees. And, I mean,
they were on a hooker mission, and someone died. And the whistleblowers, understandably, were pretty angry about this.
Yeah. So anyway, you were continuing.
Oh, just one other thing about the State Department report that I think is really important is they started to talk about these other terror groups that have gotten bigger and badder because our focus has been on Iraq and Afghanistan. We know that Al-Qaeda is rebuilding in Pakistan, but there's also an Al-Qaeda affiliate in North Africa known as AQIM. And they're big bad guys who used to just hate Algeria, and now they're expanding their terror network.
Right.
Also Indonesia, Jakarta, places like that. So,
you know, after World War II in Germany and Japan, we did not lose a single soldier in post-war hostilities in those occupations. And the reason why is because of the Marshall Plan. Because we went in and we said, we're going to help you rebuild your country. After Vietnam, Cambodia was destroyed as a consequence of our war with Vietnam. We bombed Cambodia. And when we pulled out of that area, we did not go into Cambodia and say, we'll help you rebuild the dam. I mean, we were not at war with Cambodia.
Right.
And if we had gone into Cambodia with the Marshall Plan and helped them rebuild, and you could argue the same thing about Vietnam, but then it gets very political because you're helping a communist government.
Right,
but if we'd gone back into Cambodia and said, we'll help undo the damage, Pol Pot never would have happened and 2 million people would still be alive today. I mean, this you would think that we would learn the lessons of history, that you are much more successful at preventing violence, at stopping wars, at disempowering dictators, and spreading actual democracy by going in and helping people build civil societies and civic infrastructure than you are by dropping bombs on them.
Right. You're absolutely right. And the other thing from the State Department report, I think, that is so important is, you know, we are focused. No one's saying that terrorism is not a global problem. No one's saying that we should just shut our eyes and hope everything turns out happy. But what we are saying is focusing on the wrong things, like starting a war in Iraq, has actually left the country less safe. So
using violence as our major method.
Exactly.
You know, frankly, Hamas and Hezbollah have not achieved the power that they have achieved in Gaza and in southern Lebanon as a consequence of their threats of violence. They have some power as a consequence of that, but they have most of their power, at least with regard to the local citizenry, because they're building hospitals and schools and feeding people.
Right.
And we should be doing the same.
More on how, you know, we're just doing this fight inefficiently, if you will. Did you see the story about Nelson Mandela today?
No.
It turns out, we just found out, Nelson Mandela is on the U.S. terror watch list.
Oh, no.
Nelson Mandela, the international symbol of freedom, is on our terror watch list.
Well, you know,
permission to visit the U.S.
You know, John McCain voted against the sanctions against the apartheid government back in the day.
Oh, really? I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
Well, Condoleezza Rice said she's embarrassed. So, boy, was her face right on this one, I guess. But
incredible.
Goes to show.
Incredible. Christy Harvey, you can read all about it over at AmericanProgress.org, the Center for American Progress, and MikeCheckRadio.org. Christy, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks a lot.
Always good talking to you. 45 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
dreaming of democracy in America, and you know how you make it happen? You show up. For example, May 3rd, the Coquille in the Coquille Community Center, Coquille, the Coos County Democrats in Coquille, I'll be at 115 North Birch, a fundraiser. This is $22.50 if purchased before April 15, which, well, we're still, we're after April 15 now. It's $25. Sorry about that. I'll be there. Bill Bradbury, Steve Novick, and others. This is May 3rd, 5 to 9 p.m. in Coquille, Coos County Democrats. Should be a lot of fun. Should be a hoot, so check it out. Victoria Jones on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
It's been a long time since we've talked. It's great to hear your voice again.
It's good to talk to you. I know. It's always too long between talks. I miss it.
Yeah, me too. As much as I love Ellen, I also missed talking to you. So how are you, and how's everything? What's going on in the world?
Well, what's going on in my little world is that I was dissed at the White House today.
Oh, really?
Yes, I was. By Tony Fratter. Well, I was asking my question, and my question had to do with the new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll,
which said.
Which said, among other things, that only 15% of the people who responded think that the country's going in the right direction, and only 27% of those responding think that the president's got a good job performance.
So right. He's got a lower approval rating than Reverend Wright.
That's pretty pathetic.
That's bizarre.
So I put both of those to Tony Fratto, and said that, you know, that's what they were. And was the president aware of this, and what was his reaction to it? And he indicated that the president didn't know anything, you know, just what wasn't.
He's in his bubble. Thank you very
much. And I said, well, do you think perhaps he should be aware of it? And he said, no. And turned away.
Amazing. Victoria, just in the midst of this, Marilyn in Los Angeles had a suggestion for how we should use our tax rebates. I just want to pop her in here for a second. Marilyn,
yes.
Can you real quickly share your suggestion with us?
Thank you, Tom, and you're the one who got me on this path, and I suggest that people...
Yes?
...defense fund. This man is heroic. He's a political target, and he needs our help, and he might be pivotal in breaking open all the problems and the corruption at the Department of Justice.
You're absolutely right. The Don Siegelman Defense Fund, and his website is Don Siegelman, I-before-E, donsiegelman.org. Marilyn,
yep.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Victoria, back to the news of the day.
Well, yes, well, I mentioned that story not so much because it's about me, but because it seems to be indicative of the so remark by the vice president, a kind of lack of interest in what the public thinks about them.
Yeah, which is rather regal. You know, it's kind of Louis the whatever it was, Louis the 16th, 15th. I can't keep my Louis straight, but Louis and Marie Antoinette, you know, it's just the little people.
I think it was Louis the 16th.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, whichever one it was, he didn't end up too well.
No, he didn't ultimately.
No, he didn't.
Even though Thomas Paine went over and tried to plead with the revolution not to cut his head off, then they put Thomas Paine in prison and said, we're going to cut your head off. And
yes,
James Madison had to bail him out.
So, what a mess with those guys. They were on a roll.
They really were. The French Revolution. Man, good old Maximilian, what's his name? Anyhow, onward with the news here.
So that was rather disturbing to me. Of course, we are at the fifth anniversary of Mission Accomplished.
Yes.
John McCain says that the president shouldn't be blamed for that banner, but that he does think that he can be criticized for the early months of the war, but he doesn't think he can be blamed for the banner. Why not? I don't know, seeing as the White House got the banner themselves.
Right. I mean, well, first the White House said to the New York Times this was something that the soldiers put up because they were coming home and so their mission was accomplished. And then when the soldiers, when the Navy said, no, we didn't put it up, you guys put it up, then the president said, it was somebody, you know, some overzealous group, you know, that was associated with us somehow. And they said, no. It turns out that it was the president's personal republic. The RNC actually paid for the banner, and it was the advance team for the president. The same people who, you know, dressed him up in the flight suit and put the sock in his pants and the whole bit. That was the bunch.
And, of course, Dana Perino yesterday pointed out to us that really what it should have said was, and then she spelled out very slowly for us, for those of us who were a bit slow, mission accomplished, blah, 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 which, of course, wouldn't have fitted on the banner and was not perhaps what had been intended anyway.
Do you think she actually believes this stuff?
I find that a very difficult question to answer. I like Dana.
Well, let me not put you on the spot then with it. So, you know, we can move.
But my answer is that I don't know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know the answer because I would find it hard to believe that you could believe it. But she seems to be such a sincere person.
But see, after the fact, Scott McClellan essentially came out and said, you know, there were a few times when I was lying and I knew I was lying.
Exactly. So I don't know whether she will come out and say the same thing. But he went through some pretty dreadful times, too. She hasn't been through anything quite like that yet.
Right. And one of Clinton's press secretaries, as I recall, went through, you know, essentially said the same thing. But it's got to be a tough job.
It's a very tough job. You're put out there to spin, and that's what you have to do. And there have to be days when you know that you're spinning a line and days when you fervently believe in what you're doing. And on the days when you're spinning a line, you've got to believe that you're doing it for the good of the party.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, for the good of the party, when really shouldn't the press secretary's job be the good of the country?
You would think so.
I would think so, yeah. And I think, frankly, you know, during the Eisenhower administration, during the Kennedy administration, well, who knows? I don't know. Maybe I'm engaging in inappropriate nostalgia.
I think it may be a little bit of revisionist history. I suspect they were always pretty political.
Yeah, probably all the way back to Jefferson and Washington.
Yes.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Read all about it over at talkradionews.com. And thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We've had a number of emails and calls, by the way. Where is that Joe Republican thing you read by Mr. Gray? It's up over at TomHartman.com if you're looking for it. Tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie and Anything Goes Friday. Your chance to ask a U.S. Senator your question, Senator Bernie Sanders. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there, get active, show up, participate, tag, you're it. You make it all happen.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.